A road beaten by countless generations of elephant wound down the escarpment of the Rift Valley, but it was narrow and they were forced to spend much time and labour widening it before they could carry the boats to the lower reaches of the river below the Kabalega Falls. At last they relaunched the flotilla and rowed into the centre of the flow. The current was swift and sped them northwards, but it was also treacherous. In as many days they lost 5 boats on the fangs of the submerged rocks. 3 men were drowned and 6 of the horses with them. Almost all of the other boats were battered and scarred by the time they came out into the open waters of Semliki Nyanzu Lake. Even in the short time since the Nile had begun to flow again, its waters had been replenished dramatically. They were no longer shallow and muddy, and sparkled blue in the sunlight. Across the wide waters to the north, the vague blue outline of the far shore was just visible, but to the west there was no glimpse of land. There were many new villages along the near shore that had not been there when last they passed this way. It was obvious that they had recently been inhabited, for freshly caught catfish were laid out on the smoking racks, and hot embers glowed in the fireplaces, but the people had fled at the approach of the flotilla. "I know this tribe. They are timid fishermen and will not threaten us," Imbali told Taita. "These are dangerous times and they are surrounded by warlike tribes, which is why they have run away." Taita ordered that the boats be dragged ashore for repairs to their hulls. He left Tinat and Merin in charge of the encampment. He and Fen took Nakontu and Imbali with them to act as interpreters and set off in one of the undamaged boats towards the western end of the lake and the mouth of the Semliki River. Taita was determined to find out if this other large tributary of the Nile was flowing again, or if it was still dammed by the malevolent influence of Eos. When they reached Karnak, he must be able to inform Pharaoh of all these matters, which were essential to the welfare of Egypt. The wind stood fair from the east, and they were able to hoist the lateen sail to aid the efforts of the crew on the rowing benches. With the bow wave curling under the prow, they bore away along a shoreline of white beaches and rocky headlands, with a rampart of blue mountains on the horizon. On the fifth day, they reached the mouth of a broad, swift river discharging into the lake from the south. "Is this the Semliki?" Taita demanded of Imbali. "I have never ventured so far east before. I cannot tell," she answered. "I must be certain of it. We must find some of the people who live here." The inhabitants of the villages along the banks had also fled as soon as they saw the boat, but at last they spotted a decrepit dugout canoe far out in the lake. The 2 old men on board were so busy that they did not see the boat until it was upon them. Then they abandoned their net and tried to make a dash for the beach, but they had no chance of outrunning the galley. They gave up in despair and resigned themselves to the cooking pot. Once the 2 greybeards had realized they were not to be eaten, they became garrulous with relief. When Imbali questioned them, they confirmed readily that this river was indeed the Semliki, and that until very recently it had been dry. They described the miraculous manner of its resuscitation. At a time when the earth and the mountains shivered and rocked, and the lake waters were tossed by waves as high as the skies, the river had come down in full spate and was now running as high as it had done many years ago. Taita rewarded them with a gift of beads and copper spearheads, then sent the 2 old fishermen on their way, astonished by the extent of their good fortune. "Our work here is done," Taita told Fen. "Now we can return to Egypt." When they arrived back at the encampment at the mouth of the Nile, they found that Merin and Tinat had completed the repairs to the damaged hulls, and the flotilla was seaworthy once more. Taita waited for the rise of the noon wind before he gave the order to weigh anchor. Hoisting the lateen sails and running out the oars, they bore away across the open waters of the lake. With the wind on their best point of sailing, they reached the northern shore before sunset and sailed into the branch of the Nile that was augmented with the waters of the 2 mighty lakes, Nalubale and Semliki Nyanzu. It took them northwards through the territory they had traversed on their journey south. The next impediment to their voyage was the deadly belt of tsetse fly. They had long ago used up the last of the tolas cakes. that sovereign cure for the horse sickness, so as soon as the first fly flitted from the near bank to land on the deck of the leading boat, Taita ordered a change of course and took the flotilla into the centre of the river. They ran down in line astern, and it soon became clear that his instinct had been accurate. The fly would not cross open water to reach the boats in the middle. So they sailed on unmolested. At nightfall, Taita would not allow any of the boats to approach the bank, let alone land upon it, and they sailed on in darkness, lit by a gibbous moon. For 2 more days and 3 nights they kept strictly to the middle of the current. At last they made out in the distance the hills shaped like a virgin's breasts, which marked the northern boundary of the flybelt. Still, Taita would not place the horses at risk, and they sailed on for many more leagues before he ordered the first tentative approach to the bank. To his relief, they found no sign of the fly, and the run to Fort Adari was clear. Colonel Tinnat was particularly anxious to discover what had become of the garrison he had left at the fort almost 11 years previously. It was his duty, he felt, to rescue the exiles and take them back to their homeland. When the flotilla was level with the hills on which the fort stood, they moored the boats to the bank and offloaded the horses. It was good to be released for a while from the tedium of river travel, and to have good horses under them again, so Taita, Fenn, and Tinnat were in high spirits as they rode with a group of mounted men through the pass and were able to look down on the grassy plateau that surrounded the fort. "Do you remember Tolas, the horse surgeon?" Fenn asked. "I look forward to seeing him again. He taught me so much." "He was a wonder with horses," Taita agreed. "He coveted Windsmoke and could certainly recognize a good mount when he saw one." He patted the mare's neck, and she twitched her ears back to listen to his voice. "He wanted to steal you from me, didn't he?" She blew through her nose and nodded. "You would probably have gone with him willingly, too, you unfaithful old strumpet." They rode on towards the fort, but before they had gone much further, they had the first inkling that something was seriously wrong. There were no horses or cattle in the pastures. No smoke rose from within the walls, and no banners flew above the parapets. "Where are all my people?" Tinnat fretted. "Rabat is a reliable man. I expected him to have spotted us by now, if he is still here." They trotted on anxiously until Taita exclaimed, "The walls are in a sad state of repair. The whole place seems deserted." "The watchtower has been damaged by fire," Tinnat observed, and they urged the horses into a canter. When they reached the gates of the fort, they found them standing open. They paused at the entrance and looked through into the interior. The walls were blackened by fire. Tinnat rose in the stirrups and hailed the deserted parapet in a stentorian bellow. He received no reply, and they drew their weapons. But they were many months too late to be of assistance to the garrison. When they rode through the gates, they found their pathetic remains scattered around the cooking fires in the central courtyard. "Chima," Taita said, as they looked down at the evidence of the cannibal banquet. To get at the marrow, the Chima had roasted the long bones of the arms and legs on the open fires, then cracked them open between large stones. The shattered fragments were scattered all about. They had treated the severed heads of their victims in the same way, throwing them into the flames until they were scorched and blackened, then chopping them open as though they were boiled ostrich eggs. Taita imagined them sitting in a ring, passing round the open skulls, scooping out the half-cooked brains with their fingers and cramming them into their mouths. Taita made an approximate count of the skulls. It seems that none of the garrison escaped. The Chima had them all, men, women, and children. There were no words to express their horror and revulsion. "Look," Fenn whispered. "That must have been a tiny baby. The skull is not much larger than a ripe pomegranate." Her eyes were bright with tears. "Gather up the remains," Taita ordered. "We must bury them before we go back to the boats." They dug a small communal grave outside the walls, for there was little to lay to rest. "We have still to pass through the land of the Chima." Tinnat's face was cold and set. "If the gods are kind, they will allow me a chance to settle the score with those murderous dogs." Before they left, they searched the fort and the forest around it, hoping for some sign of survivors. But there was none. "They must have been taken unawares," Tinnett said. "There is no evidence of any fighting." They rowed back to the river in sombre silence, and on the following day resumed the journey. When they reached the territory of the Chima, Taita ordered two small detachments of mounted scouts to be landed, one on either bank. "Ride ahead and keep a sharp eye open. We will stay well behind you so that we do not alarm the Chima. If you find any sign of them, you must ride back at once to give us warning." On the fourth day, Tinat was granted his wish. They rounded another wide bend of the river and saw Hilto with his scouts waving to them from the bank. Hilto jumped aboard as the leading boat grounded and hurried to salute Taita. "Magus, there is a large village of Chima on the river bank not far ahead. 200 or 300 of the savages are gathered there." "Did any spot you?" Taita demanded. "No, they suspect nothing amiss," Hilto replied. "Good." Taita summoned Tinat and Merin from the other boats and quickly explained his plan of attack. "It was the men under Colonel Tinat's command who were massacred, so he has the right and obligation to vengeance. Colonel, this evening you will take a strong force ashore. To avoid being seen by the Chima, you must make a night march. Under cover of darkness, take up a position between the village and the edge of the forest. At first light, we will bring the boats to the village, then flush the Chima from their huts with a blast on the trumpets and a volley or two of arrows. They will almost certainly bolt for the trees, and will be looking over their shoulders when they run into your men. Have you any questions?" "It is a good, simple plan," Merin said, and Tinat nodded agreement. Taita went on. "As soon as the Chima run, Merin and I will land the rest of our men and go after them. We should be able to catch them between us in a pincer movement. Now, remember what we found inside the walls of Fort Adari? We will take no slaves or captives. Kill every last one." At dusk, Hilto, who had studied the location and layout of the village, led Tinat's column down the riverbank. The boats remained moored to the bank for the night. Taita and Fenn spread their sleeping mat on the foredeck and lay gazing up at the night sky. Fenn loved to listen to his discourse on the heavenly bodies, the legend and myths of the constellations. But in the end she always came back to the same subject. "Tell me again about my own star, Magus, the star of Lostris that I became after my death in the other life. But start at the beginning. Tell me how I died and how you embalmed me and decorated my tomb." She allowed him to omit not a single detail. As she always did, she wept quietly when he reached the part of the story where he cut the lock of her hair, then made the periapt of Lostris. She reached across and cupped the talisman in her palm. "Did you always believe that I would come back to you?" she asked. "Always. Every night I watched for the rise of your star and waited for the time when it would disappear from the firmament. I knew that that would be the sign that you were returning to me." "You must have been very sad and lonely." "Without you, my life was an empty desert," he said, and she wept again. "Oh, my Taita, that is the most sad and beautiful story ever told. Please make love to me now. I ache for you with all my body and all my soul. I want to feel you inside me, touching my core. We must never be parted from each other again."